sci-fi show, Outcast. Welcome to the 24th Sci-Fi Show Outcast. Today I have an interview with author, podcaster and professor Paul Levinson. We discuss his writings and his work and all sorts of stuff. So, enjoy. Thank you for joining us on the Sci-Fi Show today, Paul Levinson.
Delighted to be here.
So first up, can you tell me a bit about yourself, your background and who you are?
Well, that would probably take up about five podcasts, so I'll try to give you the short version because I wear a whole bunch of hats. And in no particular order of importance or priority, because all of these things are important to me. I'm a science fiction author. I have five novels published. My most recent one is The Plot to Save Socrates. I have three novels that feature my New York City forensic detective, Dr. Phil D'Amato. That's The Silk Code and The Consciousness Plague and The Pixel Eye, and I have one standalone novel about the first starship to Alpha Centauri, that's Borrowed Tides. I've also written a whole bunch of stories, and in addition to that, I've written about nine nonfiction books. These are on the history and future and philosophy of communications media. They've been translated into about a dozen languages, including Chinese and Japanese and Korean and a whole bunch of European languages. I'm also a professor and chair right now of the Department of Communication and Media Studies at Fordham University in the Bronx. And I in the past, I've been a songwriter, although I guess you never stop being something like that, so I still occasionally write a song, and I've had some records out. And the most recent addition to my very sparsely filled life as far as work is concerned is my podcast, LightOnLightThrough.com, which I'm really having a great time doing.
Great. Yeah, I noticed that you'd been a musician in the past when I was looking up some biographical information for this interview.
Well, you know, I think music is a very profound part of human life. There are some theorists, anthropologists, who even think that we were musical before we were linguistic, and it's certainly something that's very deep in people and you know, deep in me as well, and I get an enormous amount of satisfaction from it.
Fair enough. So what's the the philosophy of media and communications?
Yeah, well, and of course, you know, philosophy is used very often in somewhat different ways. I was once having a conversation with Marshall McLuhan, in which I said to him, "You, Marshall McLuhan, are one of the great philosophers of media." And he said, "Oh, no, I'm not, you know, a philosopher. I don't care about strict logic." And, you know, you don't have to be a logician or use an Aristotelian or any other formal system of logic in order to be a philosopher or take a philosophic approach to media. But there are several areas of traditional philosophy in which I think the study of media really does fit right in. If you think about Kant and his notion of what we can know about the world and the universe, and you know, we can never penetrate to the thing in itself, and all that we really can perceive are what you know, Kant would call our innate categories, what today we would probably call cognitive structures. One of the things I've done a lot of work on is how media interplay with and extend to some extent our cognitive structures. And it's a very interesting question because on the one hand, they clearly do give us more knowledge than we have with our naked senses. But on the other hand, there is still a Kantian barrier beyond which, no matter how powerful our media are, there is an element of reality, I think, that goes beyond what we're capable of grasping with our technology. So that's one of the interplays of philosophy and media. Another is an application of some of what Plato said, and a lot of Plato is extremely relevant to media studies, but this in particular, you know, the Plato's Meno paradox, in which Plato says we, and I think it's a very good point, that in order to know something, you have to already know something about the subject. If you think about our use of technologies to explore unknown situations, the only reason that we have confidence in those technologies is we are assuming that the technologies can perform, you know, correctly in those, you know, situations. So if you think about the Hubble telescope and, you know, the data that it's reporting to us from, you know, distant galaxies and star systems, the truth is, in a scientific sense, we have no real other worthwhile corroboration of what those images are showing us. So in a sense, we are giving a lot of faith to and putting a lot of confidence in, which I think is probably well placed, in this new technology. So I my approach to the intersection of media and philosophy is that what traditional philosophy has explored in non-mediated environments can often be very useful in helping us make better sense out of our current media world.
I see. Now, on to some of your writings. Your most recent book, The Plot to Save Socrates. That's an interesting title. Could you tell us a bit about what that's about? Although, I guess, don't spoil it for anyone who wants to have a read.
No, I won't spoil it. Well, it started when I was actually 16 years old. It was a long time ago. And I was a freshman in a philosophy class at the City College of New York. And that was the first time I ever really seriously considered what Plato tells happened in the Crito, which, as I'm sure many people know, Socrates has already been sentenced to death. He's going to be obliged to drink the hemlock. And according to the account that Plato presents, Socrates receives a visitor the night before the ship from Delos is to arrive. And the visitor, Crito, says to Socrates, you have, you know, an opportunity to escape. You know, you can have your wife and kids on a boat. We'll get out of here. You know, go to another city. You can continue your philosophy. Socrates incredibly says no. And this has become a really major pivotal point in human history that, you know, Socrates, on the one hand, criticizes the state but doesn't seek to put himself above the state. And that always bothered me, in part because, I mean, when I was 16, but I feel the same way now, had I been in the position of Socrates, I would have taken the escape offer of Crito and gotten out of there before the ship from Delos arrived, and I was then obliged to drink the hemlock. So, you know, when something bothers you, when you read something and it sort of grabs you and catches you, if you're also a writer, which I've always thought of myself as being, I knew that sooner or later I was going to write something about it. And so The Plot to Save Socrates, although it's a lot of fun, I think, and there are all kinds of things going on in there, and I have a great time with time travel paradoxes, and, you know, those are another story, but the historical part of it and the relationship of Socrates and, you know, to Alcibiades and Plato and Antisthenes and, you know, the various people which we can assume were probably based on real people that come down to us from Greek and Roman history. I had a really good time doing that, and I came up with what I think are some better explanations for why Socrates did what he did than have been handed down to us.
Okay, sounds like an interesting read. I'll have to pick it up. And you also recently had an audio drama out, if I understand correctly, the Chronology Protection Case?
Yes, that also, it's both science and philosophy. And I mentioned as when I was just talking a few seconds ago about time travel, which I think is an enormous amount of fun to write about in fiction, because truthfully, I don't think it can ever happen. I think you can, you know, come up with hypothetical situations that, yes, if we travel to the past and we change something in the past which would undermine our traveling to the past in the first place, that a new universe instantly pops into being, and then there are two versions of ourselves. Version A, which is motivated to travel to the past to change something because that bad thing existed in version A, but then as soon as we change it, we're in version B. But this alternate universe hypothesis, although it is a legitimate scientific hypothesis, that seems to me to be even more incredible than time travel to some extent. And travel to the future has its own problems. If we were able to travel to the future, and if, for example, someone could travel, say, 5 minutes into the future and hear this conversation that we're having, that would mean that you and I would have no free will over, you know, what we're saying. And I believe very deeply in free will. I just can't imagine that the universe would exist where what I was saying was programmed. So I always thought that there were problems with time travel. So believing and concluding that time travel was impossible, as I was just saying, and, you know, that's, by the way, why it makes such exciting and enjoyable fiction, because it's fun to play with things that almost seem like they are possible, but I think, in fact, are not. But it was at this point that I came upon Stephen Hawking's, what he calls the chronology protection conjecture. And, you know, I took to that like a fish to water, because it was speaking to exactly what I was feeling and concluding, even though I didn't, you know, work out any equations, you know, to explain that. Hawking's brilliant point, I thought, was that even if we could somehow invent a technology that would enable us to travel in time, even if someone could put up mathematical equations that could explain how the time travel would take place, the universe would never allow that to happen. Because if you had people traveling around in time, you know, going to the past, you know, going to the future, the whole cause and effect nature of existence would become totally twisted and severed and unraveled. And Hawking said the universe would protect itself from that. And what he, of course, had in mind is that the universe would just create insurmountable obstacles. So, in other words, if we were able to discover a wormhole or build an artificial wormhole, which would enable us to time travel, Hawking thought that the universe would prevent that travel from happening. It would create some kind of physical disturbance that would make the actual time travel impossible. But in my devious mind, somehow, one fine day, what blossomed in my head was, here is, you know, something that could be the makings of a murder mystery. Because let's say you had some scientists who thought they discovered how to time travel. What would the universe in a chronology protection conjecture situation do about that? The universe certainly wouldn't let the scientists proceed very far with their work. And so that's how the chronology protection case came to be written. And it also introduced my New York City forensic detective, Dr. Phil D'Amato, who, as I mentioned before, later on appeared in three novels. The novelette, which is what it was, which is really just a name for a long, short story, it was about 8,000 words, it was published in 1995, in the September 1995 issue of Analog Magazine. And it had a great run. It was reprinted in a couple of anthologies. It was reprinted by Jack Dann in one of the Nebula Award anthologies. And it was reprinted in a Supernatural Sleuth short story collection. And then around 2002, a fellow by the name of Jay Kenzinger, lives in California, made a very low-budget film of the chronology protection case. And it's really low-budget, but I think it's a very charming film. In fact, I just 2-3 days ago got from Jay a note that he had put up on YouTube a trailer for the chronology protection case movie. And I have actually now that trailer. People can see it on my webpage if they like, on Light On, Light through.com. But about a year after the movie was made, Mark Shanahan, a very talented voiceover artist, Broadway actor, saw the movie, read the novelette, and decided to write a radio play of it. So the radio play was performed at the Museum of Television and Radio in New York City. It was then re-recorded in a studio, and It's this radio play that I was recently able to get some MP3 copies of and offer. And the offer, by the way, still holds for any of your listeners as well, because it's easy enough to make more MP3 copies. That I created a little contest, because, you know, I don't like giving things away that easily. But anyone who wants to log on to my website, lightonlightthrough.com, and identify the condiment which was formerly a vegetable, that's the key, the continent that was formerly a vegetable, that you can see on that website. And all you have to do is email me, and you can click on the email, links that are on the website, or it's just Paul Levinson, one word, at lightonlightthrough.com. I will email a copy of the MP3 of the Chronology Protection Case. And it's a great production, by the way. As I said, it's a studio production. It has music, sound effects. To me, it sounds, and I know Mark is a great fan of this, like a 1940s radio play, but brought a little bit up to date because, obviously our recording techniques are better now. But it's a lot of fun, and I'm very happy with it.
Great. So you do all this writing, and where do you get your ideas from?
Well, for me, the question is never where do I get the ideas, it's where will I get the time to write these ideas. I just get ideas from everything. For me, to be alive, to be walking down the street, to be driving a car, to be having a bite to eat, to be having a conversation, to do anything is to be in a situation in which ideas are constantly percolating in my head. And so they just come from everything, whether it's, watching television or, because a lot of people say, well, hey, television is a very deadening experience, but not for me. I love television. I love the cinema, but, it's basically everything. I find the world a very stimulating place.
Fair enough. So how did you get into writing in the first place?
When I was a kid, and I guess the first science fiction that I read and that really stuck with me was Isaac Asimov's Foundation trilogy, and it really, took hold of me. And for me, whenever I have an intense experience like that as a consumer, as a reader, a part of me also can imagine being a creator as well. In other words, for me, the thorough perception of something, and here there's an interesting philosophic tie. I don't know if you and your listeners are that familiar with the philosophy of John Dewey, who many consider to be one of the great American philosophers, and I agree. And one of his points is, apropos of his name Dewey, is that we fully understand things by doing them, in addition to just thinking about them and reading about them. So I think that, to some extent, I'm an embodiment of that, because the more I read and love science fiction, the more I imagine myself as a science fiction writer. And the same was true, for nonfiction. If I would read a book or an article in a newspaper, it just seemed a natural thing for me to start writing. And the first work that I ever had professionally published was actually a letter that I sent to the editor of a local newspaper here in New York, the Village Voice. It was in response to a searing column that the Village Voice's music critic, his name was Robert Christgau, in fact he was their critic until fairly recently, had written about Paul McCartney. And I was a fan of McCartney, and I read that review, and I thought it was really, wrong. But rather than just thinking about it, I sat down and I wrote a letter and sent it off. And then, much to my delight, I got a check for $65 and a note that it was going to be published in the next issue. So that sort of gave me the idea that, if I write something, it can go beyond just, my typewriter or my desk, today we'd say, my computer, and get out there into the world. And it's a very powerful, self-fulfilling kind of loop, because the more that your work gets out there and it gets talked about, the more exciting it becomes to you when you're writing, because you realize that every word that you're writing could be seen by how many, 100, 1,000, 10,000 people. It's a very exciting feeling.
Okay. So the next question is, what would you describe your worldview as?
Well, I guess a few things. Number one, I don't think that we'll ever fully understand ourselves as a species, as sentient beings. And whether you call it a soul or an intellect, I mean, from my perspective, it doesn't really matter. It's getting at the same thing. Clearly, we're more than just rocks, and clearly, we're more than trees, and I think clearly, we're more than any other living organism, on this earth. And I guess, first and foremost, in my worldview, is that we have to get beyond this earth in order to at least have a chance of understanding that a little better. In fact, in one of my books, Real Space, one of my nonfiction, I make the point that it's a mistake to look at space exploration purely in scientific terms, or even in philosophic terms. There's a spiritual, even religious dimension to the universe, because religion and spirituality are really addressing the same question which space exploration addresses ultimately, which is namely, what are we doing here? What's our place in the universe? So, you know, you have someone like Blaise Pascal, and he's just awed by the asymmetry, the immensity of the universe compared to the tininess of us. But that asymmetry, that disproportion, is at its worst when we're down here on this planet. So I'd like to see us get off this planet. But more immediately, you know, it's tough. You know, there are a lot of people on this globe. There's a lot of tension. There's a lot, you know, there's obviously where, as a species, we have a lot of aggression. And I do tend to be an optimist. You know, we're still here, at least, you know, talking about these things. So we seem to be able to put a hold on the worst aspects of our nature. And I'm hopeful that perhaps we'll continue to improve along those lines.
Okay, one final question, or two final questions.
Sure.
Human replay, a theory of the evolution of media. What on earth is that about? That was your PhD thesis, apparently.
Yes, that's right. And I still talk about it now all the time, and here's what it is in a nutshell. First of all, to begin with, most people who study media and technology tend to be rather critical of them, meaning they see media as making us more artificial. And there's a whole philosophic tradition, you know, people like Carl Jaspers, a French media critic by the name of Jacques Ellul. Many people have made this point that, you know, whether it's television, computers, automobiles, they're turning us into automatons. They're separating us from the natural world. I actually think precisely the opposite is the case. And in my study of media, and this goes back to my doctoral dissertation, I've discovered that as media get more advanced, they get more natural, not more artificial, but less artificial and more natural. And I actually worked out a three-part schema. In the beginning, we have a complete natural palette and an array. You know, we see and hear and we can touch everything, but the problem is, in that, you know, original situation, which I call stage A, we cannot communicate beyond our physical surroundings. So we're dependent totally on our memory and on walking in order to get information from one place to another. So because of this, we invent technologies. That's stage B. Now, these first technologies in stage B are able to get information from one place to another, but they oblige us to pay a price, which is we give up a lot of the natural environment. So if you look at writing and you think about the difference between, you know, say somebody reading a document and someone hearing somebody talk, clearly a lot is lost in the reading, right? I mean, even the difference between a podcast and a blog, if you think about it, you know, they could both be about the same thing, but in a podcast you hear the speaker's voice, you get all these emotional nuances, whereas in the blog you just get the words, and they can be wonderful words, but something is lacking. And I think it's in stage B that the critics of technology get this idea that technology is dehumanizing us. Because it is true that if you're just talking about letters flattened on a page, they lack color, they lack voice, they lack dimension. There are things that are lost. But what the critics miss, and what I was trying to talk about in Human Replay, is there's a third stage, which I call stage C. And in this stage, as media evolve, they continue their extension across time and space that they do in stage B. They continue getting information out there, but they begin to retrieve elements of the natural world which had previously been lost. And so if you think about, there's no better example than look at what the web and the internet is doing today. You know, it started out just with words, then it went into, you know, images, now there's video, now there's sound, there's color. And so it's of course not the same as the real natural world, but it's bringing back into the media mix a lot of these elements that were lost. And I even came up with a term a rather awkward term, because I hoped if it was awkward, people would remember it better, called anthropotropic. Anthropo meaning human, tropic meaning towards, as in a plant having a tropism towards the sun. And I say that media evolve in an anthropotropic direction. They become more like humans, not less like humans.
Okay. Now, if people wanted to learn more about your work and your writing, where's the best place to go?
I would say two places. The place that has the most detailed stuff would be my home webpage, and that's, you know, www.sff, that's S as in Sam, FF, two Fs as in Frank, .net/people/Paul Levinson.
I'll put a link in the show notes.
Okay, good. Right.
That's simpler than trying to remember it.
Exactly. And then the other one would be my Light On, Light Through podcast page, which has an increasing amount of stuff.
Okay. I've been enjoying listening to that recently. So.
Oh, thank you.
It's a good show. Well, thank you very much for joining us today on the Sci-Fi Show, Paul.
I enjoy it immensely.
Hope everybody enjoyed that interview with Paul Levinson. Check out his podcast and check out some of his writings. And it's not too late to win a copy of the Chronology Protection Case from him. It's pretty easy to work out what you need. Anyway, talk to you next time. The Sci-Fi Show is copyright Jason Rennie, 2006. It's released under a Creative Commons Attribution Non-Commercial No Derivatives License, and the song Big Planet is used by permission of Nova Surfer. More great Nova Surfer tracks can be found at novasurfer.nl.